Now, 6 weeks before the 1936 national conventions, it was probable that neither Franklin Roosevelt, Herbert Hoover, Senator Vandenberg, Ogden Mills, General Hugh Johnson, Colonel Frank Knox, nor Senator Borah would be nominated for president by either party, and that the Republican standard-bearer, meaning the one man who never has to lug a large, bothersome, and somewhat ridiculous standard, would be that loyal yet strangely honest old-line Senator Walt Trowbridge, a man with a touch of Lincoln in him, dashes of Will Rogers and George W. Norris, a suspected trace of Jim Farley, but all the rest plain, bulky, placidly defiant Walt Trowbridge. Few men doubted that the Democratic candidate would be that skyrocket, Senator Berzelius Windrip. That is to say, Windrip as the mask and bellowing voice, with his satanic secretary, Lee Saracen, as the brain behind. Senator Windrip's father was a small-town western druggist, equally ambitious and unsuccessful, and had named him Berzelius after the Swedish chemist. Usually he was known as Buzz. He had worked his way through a Southern Baptist college of approximately the same academic standing as a Jersey City business college, and through a Chicago law school, and settled down to practice in his native state and to enliven local politics. He was a tireless traveler, a boisterous and humorous speaker, an inspired guesser at what political doctrines the people would like, a warm handshaker and willing to lend money. He drank Coca-Cola with the Methodists, beer with the Lutherans, California white wine with the Jewish village merchants, and, when they were safe from observation, white mule corn whiskey with all of them. Within 20 years he was as absolute a ruler of his state as ever a sultan was of Turkey. He was never governor. He had shrewdly seen that his reputation for research among planters' punch recipes, varieties of poker, and the psychology of girl stenographers might cause his defeat by the church people, so he had contented himself with coaxing to the gubernatorial shearing a trained baa-lamb of a country schoolmaster whom he had gaily led on a wide blue ribbon. The state was certain that he had given it a good administration, and they knew that it was Buzz Windrip who was responsible, not the governor. Windrip caused the building of impressive high roads and of consolidated country schools. He made the state buy tractors and combines and lend them to the farmers at cost. He was certain that someday America would have vast business dealings with the Russians, and, though he detested all Slavs, he made the state university put in the first course in the Russian language that had been known in all that part of the West. His most original invention was quadrupling the state militia and rewarding the best soldiers in it with training in agriculture, aviation, and radio and automobile engineering. The militiamen considered him their general and their god, and when the state attorney general announced that he was going to have Windrip indicted for having grafted $200,000 of tax money, the militia rose to Buzz Windrip's orders as though they were his private army, and occupying the legislative chambers and all the state offices, and covering the streets leading to the Capitol with machine guns, they herded Buzz's enemies out of town. He took the United States senatorship as though it were his manorial right, and for 6 years his only rival as the most bouncing and feverish man in the Senate had been the late Huey Long of Louisiana. He preached the comforting gospel of so redistributing wealth that every person in the country would have several $1,000s a year. Monthly Buzz changed his prediction as to how many thousand, while all the rich men were nevertheless to be allowed enough to get along on a maximum of $500,000 a year. So everybody was happy in the prospect of Windrip's becoming president. The Reverend Dr. Edgerton Schlemmel, Dean of St. Agnes Cathedral, San Antonio, Texas, stated, once in a sermon, once in the slightly variant mimeographed press handout on the sermon, and 7 times in interviews, that Buzz's coming into power would be like the heaven-blessed fall of revivifying rain upon a parched and thirsty land. Dr. Schlemmel did not say anything about what happened when the blessed rain came and kept falling steadily for 4 years. No one, even among the Washington correspondents, seemed to know precisely how much of a part in Senator Windrip's career was taken by his secretary, Lee Saracen. When Windrip had first seized power in his state, Saracen had been managing editor of the most widely circulated paper in all that part of the country. Saracen's genesis was and remained a mystery. It was said that he had been born in Georgia, in Minnesota, on the east side of New York, in Syria, that he was pure Yankee, Jewish, Charleston Huguenot. It was known that he had been a singularly reckless lieutenant of machine gunners as a youngster during the Great War, and that he had stayed over, ambling about Europe for 3 or 4 years, that he had worked on the Paris edition of the New York Herald, nibbled at painting and at black magic in Florence and Munich, had a few sociological months at the London School of Economics, associated with decidedly curious people in arty Berlin night restaurants. Returned home, Saracen had become decidedly the hard-boiled reporter of the shirt-sleeved tradition, who asserted that he would rather be called a prostitute than anything so sissified as journalist. But it was suspected that, nevertheless, he still retained the ability to read. He had been variously a socialist and an anarchist. Even in 1936, there were rich people who asserted that Saracen was too radical. But actually, he had lost his trust, if any, in the masses during the hoggish nationalism after the war, and he believed now only in resolute control by a small oligarchy. In this, he was a Hitler, a Mussolini. Saracen was lanky and drooping, with thin flaxen hair and thick lips and a bony face. His eyes were sparks at the bottoms of two dark wells. In his long hands there was bloodless strength. He used to surprise persons who were about to shake hands with him by suddenly bending their fingers back till they almost broke. Most people didn't much like it. As a newspaper man, he was an expert of the highest grade. He could smell out a husband murder, the grafting of a politician, that is to say, of a politician belonging to a gang opposed by his paper, the torture of animals or children, and this last sort of story he liked to write himself rather than hand it to a reporter, and when he did write it you saw the moldy cellar, heard the whip, felt the slimy blood. Compared with Lee Saracen as a newspaper man, little Doremus Jessup of Fort Beulah was like a village parson compared with the $20,000 minister of a 20-story New York institutional tabernacle with radio affiliations. Senator Windrip had made Saracen officially his secretary, but he was known to be much more: bodyguard, ghostwriter, press agent, economic advisor. And in Washington, Lee Saracen became the man most consulted and least liked by newspaper correspondents in the whole Senate office building. Windrip was a young 48 in 1936, Saracen an aged and sagging-cheeked 41. Though he probably based it on notes dictated by Windrip, himself no fool in the matter of fictional imagination, Saracen had certainly done the actual writing of Windrip's lone book, the Bible of his followers, part biography, part economic program, and part plain exhibitionistic boasting, called Zero Hour, Over the Top. It was a salty book and contained more suggestions for remolding the world than the 3 volumes of Karl Marx and all the novels of H.G. Wells put together. Perhaps the most familiar, most quoted paragraph of Zero Hour, beloved by the provincial press because of its simple earthiness, as written by an initiate in Rosicrucian lore named Saracen, was, "When I was a little shaver back in the cornfields, we kids used to just wear one-strap suspenders on our pants, and we called them the galluses on our britches. But they held them up and saved our modesty just as much as if we had put on a high-toned limey accent and talked about braces and trousers. That's how the whole world of what they call scientific economics is like. The Marxians think that by writing of galluses as braces, they've got something that knocks the stuffings out of the old-fashioned ideas of Washington and Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. Well and all, I sure believe in using every new economic discovery like they have been worked out in the so-called fascist countries like Italy and Germany and Hungary and Poland. Yes, by thunder, and even in Japan, we probably will have to lick those little yellow men someday to keep them from pinching our vested and rightful interests in China. But don't let that keep us from grabbing off any smart ideas that those cute little beggars have worked out. I want to stand up on my hind legs and not just admit, but frankly holler right out, that we've got to change our system a lot. Maybe even change the whole Constitution, but change it legally and not by violence. To bring it up from the horseback and corduroy road epoch to the automobile and cement highway period of today. The executive has got to have a freer hand and be able to move quick in an emergency, and not be tied down by a lot of dumb shyster lawyer congressmen taking months to shoot off their mouths in debates. But, and it's a but as big as Deacon Checkerboard's hay barn back home, these new economic changes are only a means to an end. And that end is and must be fundamentally the same principles of liberty, equality, and justice that were advocated by the founding fathers of this great land back in 1776. The most confusing thing about the whole campaign of 1936 was the relationship of the two leading parties. Old Guard Republicans complained that their proud party was begging for office, hat in hand. Veteran Democrats that their traditional covered wagons were jammed with college professors, city slickers, and yachtsmen. The rival to Senator Windrip in public reverence was a political titan who seemed to have no itch for office. The Reverend Paul Peter Prang of Persepolis, Indiana, Bishop of the Methodist Episcopal Church, a man perhaps 10 years older than Windrip. His weekly radio address at 2 p.m. every Saturday was to millions the very oracle of God. So supernatural was this voice from the air that for it men delayed their golf and women even postponed their Saturday afternoon contract bridge. It was Father Charles Coughlin of Detroit who had first thought out the device of freeing himself from any censorship of his political sermons on the Mount by buying his own time on the air, it being only in the 20th century that mankind has been able to buy time as it buys soap and gasoline. This invention was almost equal in its effect on all American life and thought to Henry Ford's early conception of selling cars cheap to millions of people instead of selling a few as luxuries. But to the pioneer Father Coughlin, Bishop Paul Peter Prang was as the Ford V8 to the Model A. Prang was more sentimental than Coughlin. He shouted more. He agonized more. He reviled more enemies by name and rather scandalously. He told more funny stories and ever so many more tragic stories about the repentant deathbeds of bankers, atheists, and communists. His voice was more nasally native, and he was pure Middle West, with a New England Protestant Scotch-English ancestry, where Coughlin was always a little suspect in the Sears Roebuck regions as a Roman Catholic with an agreeable Irish accent. No man in history has ever had such an audience as Bishop Prang, nor so much apparent power. When he demanded that his auditors telegraph their congressmen to vote on a bill as he, Prang, ex-cathedra and alone, without any college of cardinals, had been inspired to believe they ought to vote, then 50,000 people would telephone or drive through backhill mud to the nearest telegraph office and in his name give their commands to the government. Thus, by the magic of electricity, Prang made the position of any king in history look a little absurd and tinseled. To millions of League members he sent mimeographed letters with facsimile signature, and with the salutation so craftily typed in that they rejoiced in a personal greeting from the founder. Doremus Jessup, up in the provincial hills, could never quite figure out just what political gospel it was that Bishop Prang thundered from his Sinai, which, with its microphone and typed revelations timed to the split second, was so much more snappy and efficient than the original Sinai. In detail, he preached nationalization of the banks, mines, water power, and transportation, limitation of incomes, increased wages, strengthening of the labor unions, more fluid distribution of consumer goods. But everybody was nibbling at those noble doctrines now, from Virginia senators to Minnesota farmer laborites, with no one being so credulous as to expect any of them to be carried out. There was a theory around someplace that Prang was only the humble voice of his vast organization, the League of Forgotten Men. It was universally believed to have, though no firm of chartered accountants had yet examined its rolls, 27 million members, along with proper assortments of national officers and state officers and town officers and hordes of committees with stately names like National Committee on the Compilation of Statistics on Unemployment and Normal Employability in the Soybean Industry. Hither and yon, Bishop Prang, not as the still small voice of God but in lofty person, addressed audiences of 20,000 persons at a time, in the larger cities all over the country, speaking in huge halls meant for prize fighting, in cinema palaces, in armories, in baseball parks, in circus tents, while after the meetings his brisk assistants accepted membership applications and dues for the League of Forgotten Men. When his timid detractors hinted that this was all very romantic, very jolly and picturesque, but not particularly dignified, and Bishop Prang answered, "My master delighted to speak in whatever vulgar assembly would listen to him," no one dared answer him, "But you aren't your master, not yet." With all the flourish of the League and its mass meetings, there had never been a pretense that any tenet of the League, any pressure on Congress and the President to pass any particular bill, originated with anybody save Prang himself, with no collaboration from the committees or officers of the League. All that the Prang who so often crooned about the humility and modesty of the Savior wanted was for 130 million people to obey him, their priest-king, implicitly in everything concerning their private morals, their public asseverations, how they might earn their livings, and what relationships they might have to other wage-earners. "And that," Doremus Jessup grumbled, relishing the shocked piety of his wife Emma, "makes Brother Prang a worse tyrant than Caligula, a worse fascist than Napoleon. Mind you, I don't really believe all these rumors about Prang's grafting on membership dues and the sale of pamphlets and donations to pay for the radio. It's much worse than that. I'm afraid he's an honest fanatic. That's why he's such a real fascist menace. He's so confoundedly humanitarian, in fact so noble, that a majority of people are willing to let him boss everything. And with a country this size, that's quite a job. Quite a job, my beloved. Even for a Methodist bishop who gets enough gifts so that he can actually buy time." All the while, Walt Trowbridge, possible Republican candidate for president, suffering from the deficiency of being honest and disinclined to promise that he could work miracles, was insisting that we live in the United States of America, not on a golden highway to utopia. There was nothing exhilarating in such realism, so all this rainy week in June, with the apple blossoms and the lilacs fading, Doremus Jessup was awaiting the next encyclical of Pope Paul Peter Prang. Chapter 5. I know the press only too well. Almost all editors hide away in spider dens, men without thought of family or public interest, or the humble delights of jaunts out of doors, plotting how they can put over their lies and advance their own positions, and fill their greedy pocketbooks by calumniating statesmen who have given their all for the common good and who are vulnerable because they stand out in the fierce light that beats around the throne. Zero Hour, Berzelius Windrip. The June morning shone. The last petals of the wild cherry blossoms lay dew-covered on the grass. Robins were about their brisk business on the lawn. Doremus, by nature a late liar and pilferer of naps after he had been called at 8, was stirred to spring up and stretch his arms out fully 5 or 6 times in Swedish exercises in front of his window, looking out across the Beulah River Valley to dark masses of pine on the mountain slopes 3 miles away. Doremus and Emma had had each their own bedroom these 15 years, not altogether to her pleasure. He asserted that he couldn't share a bedroom with any person living because he was a night mutterer and liked to make a really good uprearing pillow-slapping job of turning over in bed without feeling that he was disturbing someone. It was Saturday, the day of the prang revelation, but on this crystal morning after days of rain, he did not think of prang at all, but of the fact that Philip, his son, with wife, had popped up from Worcester for the weekend, and that the whole crew of them, along with Lorinda Pike and Buck Titus, were going to have a real old-fashioned family picnic. They had all demanded it, even the fashionable Sissy, a woman who, at 18, had much concern with tennis tees, golf, and mysterious, appallingly rapid motor trips with Malcolm Tasbro, just graduating from high school, or with the Episcopal parson's grandson, Julian Falk, freshman in Amherst. Doremus had scolded that he couldn't go to any blame picnic. It was his job as editor to stay home and listen to Bishop Prang's broadcast at 2. But they had laughed at him and rumpled his hair and miscalled him until he had promised. They didn't know it, but he had slyly borrowed a portable radio from his friend, the local R.C. priest, Father Stephen Perifix, and he was going to hear Prang whether or no. He was glad they were going to have Lorinda Pike. He was fond of that sardonic saint. And Buck Titus, who was perhaps his closest intimate. James Buck Titus, who was 50 but looked 38, straight, broad-shouldered, slim-waisted, long-moustached, swarthy. Buck was the Dan'l Boone type of old American, or perhaps an Indian fighting cavalry captain out of Charles King. He had graduated from Williams with 10 weeks in England and 10 years in Montana, divided between cattle raising, prospecting, and a horse breeding ranch. His father, a richish railroad contractor, had left him the great farm near West Beulah, and Buck had come back home to grow apples, to breed Morgan stallions, and to read Voltaire, Anatole France, Nietzsche, and Dostoevsky. He served in the war as a private, detested his officers, refused a commission, and liked the Germans at Cologne. He was a useful polo player, but regarded riding to the hounds as childish. In politics, he did not so much yearn over the wrongs of labor as feel scornful of the tight-fisted exploiters who denned in office and stinking factory. He was as near to the English country squire as one may find in America. He was a bachelor with a big mid-Victorian house, well kept by a friendly Negro couple, a tidy place in which he sometimes entertained ladies who were not quite so tidy. He called himself an agnostic instead of an atheist, only because he detested the street-bawling, tract-peddling evangelicism of the professional atheists. He was cynical, he rarely smiled, and he was unwaveringly loyal to all the Jessups. His coming to the picnic made Doremus as blithe as his grandson David. Perhaps, even under fascism, the church clock will stand at 10 to 3 and there will be honey still for tea, Doremus hoped, as he put on his rather dandified country tweeds. The only stain on the preparations for the picnic was the grouchiness of the hired man, Chad Ledoux. When he was asked to turn the ice cream freezer, he growled, "Why the heck don't you folks get an electric freezer?" He grumbled most audibly at the weight of the picnic baskets, and when he was asked to clean up the basement during their absence, he retorted only with a glare of silent fury. "You ought to get rid of that fellow Ledoux," urged Doremus's son Philip, the lawyer. "Oh, I don't know," considered Doremus. "Probably just shiftlessness on my part. But I tell myself I'm doing a social experiment, trying to train him to be as gracious as the average Neanderthal man. Or perhaps I'm scared of him. He's the kind of vindictive peasant that sets fire to barns. Did you know that he actually reads, Phil?" "No." "Yep. mostly movie magazines with naked ladies and wild western stories, but he also reads the papers. Told me he greatly admired Buzz Windrip. Says Windrip will certainly be president, and then everybody, by which I'm afraid Shad means only himself, will have $5,000 a year. Buzz certainly has a bunch of philanthropists for followers. Now listen, Dad, you don't understand Senator Windrip. Oh, he's something of a demagogue. He shoots off his mouth a lot about how he'll jack up the income tax and grab the banks. But he won't. That's just molasses for the cockroaches. What he will do, and maybe only he can do it, is to protect us from the murdering, thieving, lying Bolsheviks that would... Why, they'd like to stick all of us that are going on this picnic, all the decent, clean people that are accustomed to privacy, into hall bedrooms and make us cook our cabbage soup on a Primus stuck on a bed. Yes, or maybe liquidate us entirely. No, sir, Berzelius Windrip is the fellow to balk the dirty, sneaking Jew spies that pose as American liberals. The face is the face of my reasonably competent son, Philip, but the voice is the voice of the Jew-baiter. Julius Streicher, sighed Doremus. The picnic ground was among a Stonehenge of gray and lichen-painted rocks, fronting a birch grove high up on Mount Terror, on the upland farm of Doremus's cousin, Henry Veder, a solid, reticent Vermonter of the old days. They looked through a distant mountain gap to the faint mercury of Lake Champlain, and across it the bulwark of the Adirondacks. Davy Greenhill and his hero, Buck Titus, wrestled in the hardy pasture grass. Philip and Dr. Fowler Greenhill, Doremus's son-in-law, Phil, plump and half-bald at 32, Fowler, belligerently red-headed and red-mustached, argued about the merits of the autogyro. Doremus lay with his head against a rock, his cap over his eyes, gazing down into the paradise of Beulah Valley. He could not have sworn to it, but he rather thought he saw an angel floating in the radiant upper air above the valley. The women, Emma and Mary Greenhill, Sissy and Philip's wife and Lorinda Pike, were setting out the picnic lunch, a pot of beans with crisp salt pork, fried chicken, potatoes warmed over with croutons, tea biscuits, crabapple jelly, salad, raisin pie, on a red and white tablecloth, spread on a flat rock. But for the parked motor cars, the scene might have been New England in 1885, and you could see the women in chip hats and tight-bodiced high-necked frocks with bustles. The men in straw boaters with dangling ribbons and adorned with side whiskers, Doremus's beard not clipped but flowing like a bridal veil. When Dr. Greenhill fetched down Cousin Henry Veder, a bulky yet shy enough pre-Ford farmer in clean faded overalls, then was time again unbought, secure, serene. And the conversation had a comfortable triviality, an affectionate Victorian dullness. However Doremus might fret about conditions, however skittishly Sissy might long for the presence of her beaux, Julian Falk and Malcolm Tasbro, there was nothing modern and neurotic, nothing savoring of Freud, Adler, Marx, Bertrand Russell, or any other divinity of the 1930s, when Mother Emma chattered to Mary and Marilla about her rose bushes that had winter-killed, and the new young maples that the field mice had gnawed, and the difficulty of getting Shad Ledoux to bring in enough fireplace wood, and how Shad gorged pork chops and fried potatoes and pie at lunch, which he ate at the Jessup's. And the view. The women talked about the view as honeymooners once talked at Niagara Falls. David and Buck Titus were playing ship now on a rearing rock. It was the bridge, and David was Captain Popeye, and Buck his bosun, and even Dr. Greenhill, that impetuous crusader who was constantly infuriating the County Board of Health by reporting the slovenly state of the poor farm and the stench in the county jail, was lazy in the sun, and with the greatest of concentration kept an unfortunate little ant running back and forth on a twig. His wife Mary, the golfer, the runner-up in state tennis tournaments, the giver of smart but not too bibulous cocktail parties at the country club, the wearer of smart brown tweeds with a green scarf, seemed to have dropped gracefully back into the domesticity of her mother, and to consider as a very weighty thing a recipe for celery and Roquefort sandwiches on toasted soda crackers. She was the handsome, older Jessup girl again, back in the white house with the mansard roof. And Foolish, lying on his back with his forepaws idiotically flopping, was the most pastorally old-fashioned of them all. The only serious flare of conversation was when Buck Titus snarled to Doremus, "Certainly a lot of messiahs pot-natcher from the bushes these days. Buzz Windrip and Bishop Prang and Father Coughlin and Dr. Townsend, though he seems to have gone back to Nazareth, and Upton Sinclair and Reverend Frank Buckman and Bernard McFadden and Willem Randolph Hearst and Governor Talmadge and Floyd Olson and... Say, I swear the best messiah in the whole show is this darky, Father Divine. He doesn't just promise he's going to feed the underprivileged 10 years from now. He hands out the fried drumsticks and gizzard right along with the salvation. How about him for president?" Out of nowhere appeared Julian Falk. This young man, freshman in Amherst the past year, grandson of the Episcopal rector and living with the old man because his parents were dead, was in the eyes of Doremus the most nearly tolerable of Sissy's suitors. He was swede blonde and wiry, with a neat small face and canny eyes. He called Doremus Sir, and he had, unlike most of the radio and motor-hypnotized 18-year-olds in the fort, read a book, and voluntarily. Read Thomas Wolfe and William Rollins, John Strachey and Stuart Chase and Ortega. Whether Sissy preferred him to Malcolm Tasbro, her father did not know. Malcolm was taller and thicker than Julian, and he drove his own streamlined DeSoto, while Julian could only borrow his grandfather's shocking old flivver. Sissy and Julian bickered amiably about Alice Islet's skill in backgammon, and Foolish scratched himself in the sun. But Doremus was not being pastoral. He was being anxious and scientific. While the others jeered, "When does Dad take his audition, and what's he learning to be, a crooner or a hockey announcer?" Doremus was adjusting the doubtful portable radio. Once he thought he was going to be with them in the home sweet home atmosphere, for he tuned in on a program of old songs, and all of them, including Cousin Henry Veeder, who had a hidden passion for fiddlers and barn dances and parlor organs, hummed gaily the Troubadour and Maid of Athens and Darling Nellie Gray. But when the announcer informed them that these ditties were being sponsored by Toily Oily, the natural home cathartic, and that they were being rendered by a sextet of young males horribly called the Smoothies, Doremus abruptly shut them off. "Why, what's the matter, Dad?" cried Sissy. "Smoothies! God! This country deserves what it's going to get," snapped Doremus. "Maybe we need a Buzz Windrip." The moment, then, it should have been announced by cathedral chimes, of the weekly address of Bishop Paul Peter Prang. Coming from an airless closet, smelling of sacerdotal woolen union suits in Persepolis, Indiana, it leapt to the farthest stars. It circled the world at 186,000 miles a second, 1,000,000 miles while you stopped to scratch. It crashed into the cabin of a whaler on a dark polar sea, into an office paneled with linen-fold oak looted from a Nottinghamshire castle on the 67th story of a building on Wall Street, into the Foreign Office in Tokyo, into the rocky hollow below the shining birches upon Mount Terror in Vermont. Bishop Prang spoke, as he usually did, with a grave kindliness, a virile resonance, which made his self, magically coming to them on the unseen aerial pathway, at once dominating and touched with charm. And whatever his purposes might be, his words were on the side of the angels. "My friends of the radio audience, I shall have but 6 more weekly petitions to make you before the national conventions, which will decide the fate of this distraught nation, and the time has come now to act. To act! Enough of words. Let me put together certain separated phrases out of the 6th chapter of Jeremiah, which seem to have been prophetically written for this hour of desperate crisis in America. O ye children of Benjamin, gather yourselves together to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem. Prepare ye war. Arise, and let us go up at noon. Woe unto us, for the day goeth away, for the shadows of the evening are stretched out. Arise, and let us go by night, and let us destroy her palaces. I am full of the fury of the Lord. I am weary with holding it in. I will pour it out upon the children abroad, and upon the assembly of young men together. For even the husband with the wife shall be taken, the aged with him that is full of days. I will stretch out my hand upon the inhabitants of this land, saith the Lord. For from the least of them even unto the greatest, every one is given to covetousness. And from the prophet even unto the priest, every one dealeth falsely, saying, Peace, peace, when there is no peace. So spake the book of old, but it was spoken also to America of 1936. There is no peace. For more than a year now, the League of Forgotten Men has warned the politicians, the whole government, that we are sick unto death of being the dispossessed, and that, at last, we are more than 50 million strong, no whimpering horde, but with the will, the voices, the votes, to enforce our sovereignty. We have in no uncertain way informed every politician that we demand, certain measures, and that we will brook no delay. Again and again we have demanded that both the control of credit and the power to issue money be unqualifiedly taken away from the private banks, that the soldiers not only receive the bonus they, with their blood and anguish so richly earned in 17 and 18, but that the amount agreed upon be now doubled, that all swollen incomes be severely limited and inheritances cut to such small sums as may support the heirs only in youth and in old age, that labor and farmers' unions be not merely recognized as instruments for joint bargaining, but be made, like the syndicates in Italy, official parts of the government, representing the toilers, and that international Jewish finance, and equally international Jewish communism and anarchism and atheism be, with all the stern solemnity and rigid inflexibility this great nation can show, barred from all activity. Those of you who have listened to me before will understand that I, or rather that the League of Forgotten Men, has no quarrel with individual Jews, that we are proud to have rabbis among our directors, but those subversive international organizations, which unfortunately are so largely Jewish, must be driven with whips and scorpions from off the face of the earth. These demands we have made, and how long now, O Lord, how long have the politicians and the smirking representatives of big business pretended to listen, to obey? Yes, yes, my masters of the League of Forgotten Men, yes, we understand. Just give us time. There is no more time. Their time is over, and all their unholy power. The conservative senators, the United States Chamber of Commerce, the giant bankers, the monarchs of steel and motors and electricity and coal, the brokers and the holding companies, they are all of them like the Bourbon kings, of whom it was said that they forgot nothing and they learned nothing. But they died upon the guillotine. Perhaps we can be more merciful to our Bourbons. Perhaps we can save them from the guillotine, the gallows, the swift firing squad. Perhaps we shall, in our new regime, under our new constitution, with our new deal that really will be a new deal and not an arrogant experiment, perhaps we shall merely make these big bugs of finance and politics sit on hard chairs in dingy offices, toiling unending hours with pen and typewriter as so many white-collar slaves for so many years have toiled for them. It is, as Senator Berzelius Windrip puts it, the zero hour. Now, this second, we have stopped bombarding the heedless ears of these false masters. We're going over the top. At last, after months and months of taking counsel together, the directors of the League of Forgotten Men and I myself announce that in the coming Democratic National Convention, we shall, without one smallest reservation... "Listen, listen, history being made," Doremus cried at his heedless family. "Use the tremendous strength of the millions of League members to secure the Democratic presidential nomination for Senator Berzelius Windrip, which means flatly that he will be elected, and that we of the League shall elect him as President of these United States. His program and that of the League do not in all details agree, but he has implicitly pledged himself to take our advice, and at least until election, we shall back him absolutely, with our money, with our loyalty, with our votes, with our prayers. And may the Lord guide him and us across the desert of iniquitous politics and swinishly grasping finance into the golden glory of the Promised Land. God bless you." Mrs. Jessup said cheerily, "Why, Dormouse, that bishop isn't a fascist at all. He's a regular red radical. But does this announcement of his mean anything, really?" Oh, well, Doremus reflected, he had lived with Emma for 34 years, and not oftener than once or twice a year had he wanted to murder her. Blandly he said, "Why, nothing much, except that in a couple of years now, on the ground of protecting us, the Buzz Windrip dictatorship will be regimenting everything, from where we may pray to what detective stories we may read." "Sure he will. Sometimes I'm tempted to turn communist. Funny, me with my fat-headed old Hudson River Valley Dutch ancestors," marveled Julian Falk. "Fine idea. Out of the frying pan of Windrip and Hitler into the fire of the New York Daily Worker and Stalin and automatics. The 5-year plan. I suppose they'd tell me that it's been decided by the commissar that each of my mares is to bear 6 colts a year now," snorted Buck Titus, while Dr. Fowler Greenhill jeered, "Ah, shoot, Dad. And you too, Julian, you young paranoiac. You're monomaniacs. Dictatorship? Better come into the office and let me examine your heads. Why, America's the only free nation on earth. Besides, country's too big for a revolution. No, no, couldn't happen here." Chapter 6 "I'd rather follow a wild-eyed anarchist like M. Goldman if they'd bring more Johnny Cake and Beans and Spuds into the humble cabin of the common man than a 24-carat college graduate ex-cabinet member statesman that was just interested in our turning out more limousines. Call me a socialist or any blame thing you want to, as long as you grab hold of the other end of the cross-cut saw with me and help slash the big logs of poverty and intolerance to pieces." Zero hour. Berzelius Windrip. His family, at least his wife and the cook, Mrs. Candy, and Sissy and Mary, Mrs. Fowler Greenhill, believed that Doremus was of fickle health, that any cold would surely turn into pneumonia, that he must wear his rubbers and eat his porridge and smoke fewer cigarettes and never overdo. He raged at them. He knew that though he did get staggeringly tired after a crisis in the office, a night's sleep made him a little dynamo again, and he could turn out copy faster than his spryest young reporter. He concealed his dissipations from them like any small boy from his elders, lied unscrupulously about how many cigarettes he smoked, kept concealed a flask of bourbon from which he regularly had one nip, only one, before he padded to bed, and when he had promised to go to sleep early, he turned off his light till he was sure that Emma was slumbering, then turned it on and happily read till 2, curled under the well-loved hand-woven blankets from a loom up on Mount Terror, his legs twitching like a dreaming setter's what time the chief inspector of the CID, alone and unarmed, walked into the counterfeiter's hideout. And once a month or so he sneaked down to the kitchen at 3 in the morning and made himself coffee and washed up everything so that Emma and Mrs. Candy would never know. He thought they never knew. These small deceptions gave him the ripest satisfaction in a life otherwise devoted to public service, to trying to make Shad Ledoux edge up the flower beds, to feverishly writing editorials that would excite 3% of his readers from breakfast time till noon, and by 6 p.m. be eternally forgotten. Sometimes when Emma came to loaf beside him in bed on a Sunday morning and put her comfortable arm about his thin shoulder blades, she was sick with the realization that he was growing older and more frail. His shoulders, she thought, were pathetic as those of an anemic baby. That sadness of hers, Doremus never guessed. Even just before the paper went to press, even when Shad Ledoux took off 2 hours and charged an item of $2 to have the lawnmower sharpened, instead of filing it himself, even when Sissy and her gang played the piano downstairs till 2 on nights when he did not want to lie awake, Doremus was never irritable, except usually between arising and the first life-saving cup of coffee. The wise Emma was happy when he was snappish before breakfast. It meant that he was energetic and popping with satisfactory ideas. After Bishop Prang had presented the crown to Senator Windrip as the summer hobbled nervously toward the national political conventions, Emma was disturbed. For Doremus was silent before breakfast, and he had rheumy eyes as though he was worried, as though he had slept badly. Never was he cranky. She missed hearing him croaking, "Isn't that confounded idiot, Mrs. Candy, ever going to bring in the coffee? I suppose she's sitting there reading her testament. And will you be so kind as to tell me, my good woman, why Sissy never gets up for breakfast, even after the rare nights when she goes to bed at 1 a.m.? And will you look out at that walk, covered with dead blossoms? That swine Shad hasn't swept it for a week. I swear I am going to fire him, and right away this morning." Emma would have been happy to hear these familiar animal sounds and to cluck and answer, "Oh, why, that's terrible. I'll go tell Mrs. Candy to hustle in the coffee right away." But he sat unspeaking, pale, opening his Daily Informer as though he were afraid to see what news had come in since he had left the office at 10. When Doremus, back in the 1920s, had advocated the recognition of Russia, Fort Beulah had fretted that he was turning out and out communist. He, who understood himself abnormally well, knew that far from being a left-wing radical, he was at most a mild, rather indolent, and somewhat sentimental liberal, who disliked pomposity, the heavy humor of public men, and the itch for notoriety which made popular preachers and eloquent educators and amateur play producers and rich lady reformers and rich lady sportswomen and almost every brand of rich lady come preeningly in to see newspaper editors with photographs under their arms and on their faces the simper of fake humility. But for all cruelty and intolerance and for the contempt of the fortunate for the unfortunate, he had not mere dislike, but testy hatred. He had alarmed all his fellow editors in northern New England by asserting the innocence of Tom Mooney, questioning the guilt of Sacco and Vanzetti, condemning our intrusion in Haiti and Nicaragua, advocating an increased income tax, writing in the 1932 campaign a friendly account of the socialist candidate Norman Thomas, and afterwards, to tell the truth, voting for Franklin Roosevelt, and stirring up a little local and ineffective hell regarding the serfdom of the southern sharecroppers and the California fruit pickers. He even suggested editorially that when Russia had her factories and railroads and giant farms really going, say in 1945, she might conceivably be the pleasantest country in the world for the mythical average man. When he wrote that editorial after a lunch at which he had been irritated by the smug croaking of Frank Tasbro and R.C. Crowley, he really did get into trouble. He got named Bolshevik, and in 2 days his paper lost 150 out of its 5,000 circulation. Yet he was as little of a Bolshevik as Herbert Hoover. He was, and he knew it, a small-town bourgeois intellectual. Russia forbade everything that made his toil worth enduring. Privacy, the right to think and to criticize as he freakishly pleased. To have his mind policed by peasants in uniform, rather than that he would live in an Alaska cabin, with beans and 100 books and a new pair of pants every 3 years. Once on a motor trip with Emma, he stopped in at a summer camp of communists. Most of them were city college Jews or neat Bronx dentists, spectacled and smooth-shaven except for foppish small mustaches. They were hot to welcome these New England peasants and to explain the Marxian gospel, on which, however, they furiously differed. Over macaroni and cheese and an unpainted dining shack, they longed for the black bread of Moscow. Later, Doremus chuckled to find how much they resembled the YMCA campers 20 miles down the highway, equally puritanical, hortatory, and futile, and equally given to silly games with rubber balls. Once only had he been dangerously active. He had supported the strike for union recognition against the quarry company of Francis Tasbro. Men whom Doremus had known for years, solid sits like Superintendent of Schools Emil Staubmeier and Charlie Betts of the furniture store, had muttered about riding him out of town on a rail. Tasbro reviled him, even now 8 years later. After all this, the strike had been lost, and the strike leader, an avowed communist named Karl Paschal, had gone to prison for inciting to violence. When Paschal, best of mechanics, came out, he went to work in a littered little Fort Beulah garage owned by a friendly, loquacious, belligerent Polish socialist named John Polikop. All day long, Paschal and Polikop yelpingly raided each other's trenches in the battle between social democracy and communism, and Doremus often dropped in to stir them up. That was hard for Tasbro, Staubmeier, banker Crowley, and lawyer Kitterick to bear. If Doremus had not come from 3 generations of debt-paying Vermonters, he would by now have been a penniless wandering printer, and possibly less detached about the sorrows of the dispossessed. The conservative Emma complained, "How you can tease people this way, pretending you really like greasy mechanics like this Paschal, and I suspect you even have a sneaking fondness for Shad LaDue, when you could just associate with decent, prosperous people like Frank. It's beyond me. What they must think of you sometimes. They don't understand that you're really not a socialist one bit, but really a nice, kind-hearted, responsible man. Oh, I ought to smack you, Dormouse." Not that he liked being called Dormouse, but then no one did so except Emma, and in rare slips of the tongue, Buck Titus. So it was endurable. Chapter 7. When I am protestingly dragged from my study and the family hearthside into the public meetings that I so much detest, I try to make my speech as simple and direct as those of the child Jesus talking to the doctors in the temple. 0 hour. Berzelius Windrip. Thunder in the mountains, clouds marching down the Beulah Valley, a natural darkness covering the world like black fog, and lightning that picked out ugly scarps of the hills as though they were rocks thrown up in an explosion. To such fury of the enraged heavens, Doremus awakened on that morning of late July. As abruptly as one who, in the death cell, startles out of sleep to the realization, "Today they'll hang me," he sat up, bewildered, as he reflected that today Senator Berzelius Windrip would probably be nominated for president. The Republican convention was over, with Walt Trowbridge as presidential candidate. The Democratic convention, meeting in Cleveland with a good deal of gin, strawberry soda, and sweat, had finished the committee reports, the kind words said for the flag, the assurances to the ghost of Jefferson that he would be delighted by what, if Chairman Jim Farley consented, would be done here this week. They had come to the nominations. Senator Windrip had been nominated by Colonel Dewey Hake, congressman, and power in the American Legion. Gratifying applause and hasty elimination had greeted such favorite sons of the several states as Al Smith, Carter Glass, William McAdoo, and Cordell Hull. Now on the 12th ballot there were 4 contestants left, and they, in order of votes, were Senator Windrip, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, Senator Robinson of Arkansas, and Secretary of Labor Francis Perkins. Great and dramatic shenanigans had happened, and Doremus Jessup's imagination had seen them all clearly as they were reported by the hysterical radio and by bulletins from the AP that fell red-hot and smoking upon his desk at the Informer office. In honor of Senator Robinson, the University of Arkansas brass band marched in behind a leader riding in an old horse-drawn buggy, which was plastered with great placards proclaiming "Save the Constitution" and "Robinson for Sanity." The name of Miss Perkins had been cheered for 2 hours while the delegates marched with their state banners, and President Roosevelt's name had been cheered for 3, cheered affectionately and quite homicidally, since every delegate knew that Mr. Roosevelt and Miss Perkins were far too lacking in circus tinsel and general clownishness to succeed at this critical hour of the nation's hysteria, when the electorate wanted a ringmaster revolutionist like Senator Windrip. Windrip's own demonstration, scientifically worked up beforehand by his secretary, press agent, private philosopher Lee Saracen, yielded nothing to others. For Saracen had read his Chesterton well enough to know that there is only one thing bigger than a very big thing, and that is a thing so very small that it can be seen and understood. When Colonel Dewey Hake put Buzz's name in nomination, the colonel wound up by shouting, "One thing more! Listen! It is the special request of Senator Windrip that you do not waste the time of this history-making assembly by any cheering of his name. Any cheering whatever. We of the League of Forgotten Men, yes, and women, don't want empty acclaim, but a solemn consideration of the desperate and immediate needs of 60% of the population of the United States. No cheers, but may Providence guide us in the most solemn thinking we have ever done." As he finished, down the center aisle came a private procession. But this was no parade of thousands. There were only 31 persons in it, and the only banners were 3 flags and 2 large placards. Leading it in old blue uniforms were 2 GAR veterans, and between, arm in arm with them, a Confederate in gray. They were such very little old men, all over 90, leaning one on another and glancing timidly about in the hope that no one would laugh at them. The Confederate carried a Virginia regimental banner torn as by shrapnel, and one of the Union veterans lifted high a slashed flag of the 1st Minnesota. The dutiful applause which the convention had given to the demonstrations of other candidates had been but rain patter compared with the tempest which greeted the 3 shaky, shuffling old men. On the platform the band played inaudibly "Dixie," then "When Johnny Comes Marching Home Again," and standing on his chair midway of the auditorium as a plain member of his state delegation, Buzz Windrip bowed, bowed, bowed and tried to smile, while tears started from his eyes and he sobbed helplessly, and the audience began to sob with him. Following the old men were 12 legionnaires, wounded in 1918, stumbling on wooden legs, dragging themselves between crutches. One in a wheelchair, yet so young-looking and gay, and one with a black mask before what should have been a face. Of these, one carried an enormous flag and another a placard demanding, "Our starving families must have the bonus. We want only justice. We want Buzz for president." And leading them, not wounded but upright and strong and resolute, was Major General Herman Meineke, United States Army. Not in all the memory of the older reporters had a soldier on active service ever appeared as a public political agitator. The press whispered one to another, "That general'll get canned unless Buzz is elected. Then he'd probably be made Duke of Hoboken." Following the soldiers were 10 men and women, their toes through their shoes, and wearing rags that were the more pitiful because they had been washed and rewashed till they had lost all color. With them tottered 4 pallid children, their teeth rotted out, between them just managing to hold up a placard declaring, "We are on relief. We want to become human beings again. We want Buzz." 20 feet behind came one lone tall man. The delegates had been craning around to see what would follow the relief victims. When they did see, they rose, they bellowed, they